You're with Johnny Vedmore on today's News Talk TNT.
Hello, welcome to the Johnny Vedmore Show on today's News Talk TNT. I'm excitedly sitting here waiting to talk to you all, and now I'm here. Hello and welcome. Thanks for coming back. I cannot thank you enough for tuning in and getting involved. During the show, the TNT chat is always busy with people discussing all manner of issues and a lot of gifts in there too. If you want to get involved, then come across to tntradio.live and join the conversation. I really love an interactive chat, and my regulars are a great bunch of folks, and they will welcome you into the TNT community with open arms. Now, we talked about World War III yesterday on the show, and I spoke about the potential for a cyber pandemic within the mold presented to us by the cyber polygon simulations, events run by the World Economic Forum, Sberbank, and others. Whether or not the cyber pandemic comes along with all-out global conflict is still yet to be seen. But we can expect a cyber pandemic to be forced on us in a way to change our current financial system. We all know they don't like us having multiple ways for us to pay each other for goods and services. The financial establishment wants you to have only one option, their option. You can't choose. Their totalitarian society relies on you being reliant and subservient to the systems they want to create. To get to their preferred financial system, every alternative must either be criminalized or unprofitable. And no regular people want this to actually happen. So they must cause a total collapse of the current system. Parallel Mike, who I'll be having back on the show next week, has done loads of work on what's being coined the Great Taking. They're setting up to take everything from you, whether you like it or not. And most people have no idea what that really means. I was talking about this to a lady the other day who said, "They won't get my money. I invested it in my own property." But people, these people who are doing this, they don't care what you own and what you think you own. They're just interested in taking it from you. You may have heard of the Pareto distribution, which is a mathematical model that shows how all wealth will float up to the top. That's how it works. That's how wealth works. We already know this is happening. Big companies such as BlackRock and Vanguard are perfect examples of how wealth ends up all in one place, right at the top. That's your wealth too. Once BlackRock and Vanguard have swallowed up every company, every asset, then they turn their attention to everything that's left, which is what you own. And that is being predicted by more than just a few who are in the know. There are no ways to stop this without redistribution of wealth. And that stinks so badly of communism that it comes with a history of pernicious ideology, death camps, and sometimes the worst examples of inequality that we've ever seen. I don't know how we're meant to reform the financial systems to be fair, but there are many who will profit and take advantage anytime the ideas are needed. Yet a void exists. We are going to have to continue presenting alternative structures to every part of the society which madmen are currently in the process of designing, creating, and implementing. Regardless of our own ideas, these people will continue to push their agenda upon us, whether we agree with it or not. They will happily destroy our world by experimenting with every part of our society. But their experiments are designed to make them stronger and to make us weaker. And we should always remember that and have that in mind. Now, I know I've told you so far this week that the Weekend Truth Festival is upon us. And I'd like to tell you again and remind you, because the more I remind you, the more I'm likely to go. And I think I'm probably likely to go. And I love the Lake District. So up that way, up near that way, is exactly where I want to be. If you would like to see all your favorite freedom fighters on one stage across one weekend, then listen up. The Weekend Truth Festival will feature speakers such as Katie Hopkins, Kate Shemirani, Dolores Garhill, Matt Letizier, Mark Atwood, David Clues, allegedly Dave, Sovereign Peter, many more. All of this across one weekend on the 3rd, 4th and 5th of May in Workington near the Lake District in the UK. All you need, bring a tent, a sleeping bag and some good vibes, as food stalls, workshops, bushcraft and amenities will be provided on site. For more information on this and to find out how to reserve your place at the festival, please visit weekendtruthfestival.co.uk. But don't hang around, because a limited number of places are still available, but they will go disappear quickly and you don't want to miss out on that. So come along with us. Maybe you'll see me there and I'll get to meet some more people who will end up stuck forever in my TNT chat. Ha ha. For the time being, you're listening to Today's News Talk on TNT.
Clashing on the controversies.
It's a woke society, and I am fed up with it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Multiple outlets are reporting that a transgender teenager from Maryland has been arrested after the FBI alerted local police that the youth was plotting a school shooting, allegedly in an effort to become famous. Here with the story, joining me now is TNT news producer Adam Clark, aka Ruckus. Ruckus, tell us more about this.
Thanks, Johnny. So I'm very happy that a potential disaster was averted, number one, first and foremost. This is a very sensitive topic. It's a very sensitive story. And I will not be reporting the words of the alleged would-be shooter's manifesto, although it is part of the story. So I will skip certain parts if you so wish. You're going to have to do some digging yourselves, folks, but it's not hard because it's all over the internet. It's being reported everywhere. This is not like some conspiracy theory. It's not like just the right took this and said, oh, look, these crazy people, or whatnot, or the left saying, oh, look, guns are bad. There is a serious issue happening with our youth, and I think this is the perfect place to discuss it, Johnny, all things considered. So, yes, the police did arrest this person. According to the Montgomery County Department of Police, this is Andrea Ye. Y-E is the last name, I'm sorry, of Rockville. They are a biological female who refers to herself as a male and prefers to be called Alex. Well, somehow they were saying some disturbing things, alluding to some stuff, and somehow the FBI got involved, and then they alerted the local cops about this 129-page manifesto, which was discovered. And in there, it described that he was going to commit a school shooting, detailed how she was going to intend to carry it out. It's the details I'm not going to get into. They indicated that Yi was planning to shoot up a high school and considering fantasizing about, it's kind of up in the air whether or not they were serious about picking off kids in an elementary school. So very serious stuff. A lot of talks of mental health. A lot of the outlets are reporting, I guess it's revealed in the manifesto, the motivating factor appears to be the person wanted fame and attention. They wanted to be famous. And that is deeply disturbing above all things, in my opinion. The MCPD was notified of the manifesto by the FBI. They subsequently investigated the matter in concert with the FBI's Baltimore field office. After obtaining a search warrant, the MCPD found internet searches, drawings, and documents, quote, related to threats of mass violence, end quote. Yi allegedly contemplated targeting Lakewood Elementary School and said, quote, that she wants to be famous, end quote. He has been charged with threats of mass violence and is being held at the Montgomery County Central Processing Unit while awaiting her bond hearing. Of course, I don't need to tell you all what might have happened if officials had not intervened, but I can't help but get over this concept of somebody trying to be famous by, you know, doing these types of things. There was one not that long ago that similar, a Nazi supporting trans person in Oregon was arrested in Oregon after threatening to, quote, go out in a blaze of glory, end quote. And of course, there's still much debate and mystery surrounding one of the more popular, or not popular, but infamous, more well-known shootings involving a trans shooter involving children, and we have yet to see the manifesto in that case. And so it's interesting to see in this case they came out front and forward with a alleged manifesto. But what do you think about all of this, Johnny?
Yeah, I think manifestos are a clear sign that people were, you know, people don't write a manifesto and then just not do the thing that they want to do. It's a clear sign that there's an issue there. I mean, you look at the Unabomber's manifesto, you look at Anders Behring Breivik, you know, it's whatever act and whatever perpetrator, they often want not only themselves to be famous, but they want that act to propel on their ideas into infamy. And it doesn't matter what gender, sexuality, what person, who you are. If you're writing up a manifesto and then planning to kill kids, you're a sick person that needs help. And what we know about our society right now is there's a load of sick people that need help. This person would probably never have got to this stage if there was more counseling available, more talking therapies, more ability for people to actually have a conversation about why they're sad with society, why they don't like society. Maybe even that would be the same for Anders Behring Breivik when he was growing up, you know? Maybe if we actually managed to learn how to speak with each other properly and how to communicate with each other, especially about the hardest issues of the day, because we know the trans topic has been trending in that sense for the past 10 years. So it's not a surprise to see that it's something that's trending that someone then wants to latch onto, that then someone wants to use as a way to propel their ideas forward. I mean, the fame and trending is very, like, it's hyperlinked, isn't it? It's it's a shadow of the one is a shadow of the other. You don't go anywhere without finding a pernicious ideology behind an act of savagery being perpetrated by someone who's mixed up, confused, and doesn't know what's going on. It does not matter who they are. If you're writing up a manifesto and going out to kill children, you've obviously, you know, you and it's lacking in humanity. It's lacking in everything. I go back to one Monday back years ago when I was a kid and remembering hearing about what happened in Dunblane. And you talked about an elementary school there. And a guy went in and he shot up a load of people in kids in an elementary school. I mean, it was possibly one of the most devastating tragedies to ever happen in Scotland, that's for sure. And that person, you know, they probably would have loved to put all of their ideas out there to get their attention. You're right not to, I sometimes think you're not right to say we shouldn't be looking at their manifesto and their ideas to try and understand more, but you won't learn anything. You'll just learn the hate that they want to propel out. You won't learn why, where that hate originated from. So I'm like you. I am very ruckus. I'm very, very glad that this was avoided. I take it the person was arrested and taken into custody, and this is going to go through a trial, is it?
Well, they're being held currently, so I don't have an update beyond that, unfortunately, at this moment. But yeah, I don't think, well, I mean, depending on if it's a blue city with a DA who's been paid by Soros, I'm just kidding, folks. I was going to suggest that they might be let out already because that's the way some of those folks like to treat crime. No, I imagine that the person is safely still in custody. So I hope I'm not wrong about that. But yes, I I think that to what degree, because these things, as you mentioned, and we've been seeing this a lot, it's nothing new. There's always the question of the mental health. And then that leads to the next question, since in this case, the person was known to have mental health issues. First of all, like, okay, well, what are we doing about that? Well, usually what we're doing about that is putting them on pharmaceuticals. And that's usually a common thread in these types of things, Johnny. But I'm fascinated and frightened by this addition now. We live in a world where people are inundated with social media and TikTok stardom and the likes. And I think that a lot of that is starting to play into these twisted young minds, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately it is. What I see is trending culture, trending ideology, motivating the most, usually the most harmed, mentally harmed people in society, to do things that are just inhumane. And that's partially because they're being treated inhumanely too. And I don't want to give, you know, all of the benefit of the doubt to a lot of these people. But if you have no care, you have no therapy, and you have no support, then you end up in trauma. And if trauma is the way you live your life, you make very bad decisions. And we need to learn to live in a society without trauma. Thank you, Ruckus, for bringing us that very, sad story.
Intense story, at least. Hopefully we'll have something better next hour, Johnny.
Yep, I look forward to it. You're listening to today's News Talk on TNT.
TNT's Jason Burmess.
Now, whether you like Donald Trump or you think he's literally Hitler, have we ever been in a situation where a person who has led this country could not take a day off from what is obviously a show trial in every respect, way, shape, and form to go see their kid graduate high school? Oh, Jason, he's a billionaire. He doesn't care. That's his like fifth kid. Who cares? How dare you, Jason? He's already got Don Jr. and Eric. He got to go to those. Look, the bottom line is this is grotesque on every level, and it shows how lawfare is being waged against anyone who goes against the narrative, even the President of the United States. And this is very dangerous.
Jason Burmess on today's News Talk, TNT.
Internet. A stream online.
TNTRadio.live. Today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Hello there. Welcome back to the Johnny Vedmore Show on today's News Talk TNT. Well, we should get straight into it because my first guest is a brilliant journalist. We spoke to him a couple of weeks ago, but since then, me and him have had a longer chat, and soonish I will even be doing a couple of Johnny Vedmore read-throughs of some of his work. For now, Tim Hinchliffe is the founder of sociable.co, where he publishes his must-read articles which expose the coming agenda. His most recent piece, released a couple of days ago, is entitled, and I don't know if I'm getting his name right, Nilekani Karstens proposed digital ID CBDC-powered Finternet to be the future financial system, BIS report. Tim, welcome back on the Johnny Vedmore Show. Fantastic to have your bulging brain returning to us again. Can you create a good launch pad for diving into your most recent article?
Well, sure thing. Yeah, and thanks for having me on again. It's a pleasure. Just one correction on the intro there. I'm not the founder. I am the editor of Sociable, but not the founder. But yes, getting into the fintech or finternet. So this was just a paper that was published on the Bank for International Settlements website. It's a working paper, and it's called, what is it called? Finternet, the Financial System for the Future. Now, the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, is supposedly, they call themselves the central bank for central banks, and they've been talking about a future financial system for years now, quite a long time, and they talk about unified ledgers, and they talk about CBDC, central bank digital currencies. But this is where they kind of put it all together in this report. And in fact, they're going to have a presentation on this, those two, Nandan Nilekani and Augustine Karstens, in a couple of hours. So I'm looking forward to that. But anyway, in a nutshell, what the Finternet is straight from their mouths. I'll try to do it in Karsten's voice. We propose the concept of the Finternet as a vision for the future financial system. Multiple financial ecosystems interconnected with each other. So what they say it's going to do, the Finternet, it would be designed to empower individuals and businesses by placing them at the center of their financial lives. And unified ledgers is central to everything. And unified ledgers is where you get programmability in the digital money, you get tokenized deposits, you get CBDC, and all this runs on, you need a digital identity as well to have this. So all these pieces are being put together. So the two authors, Nandan Nilekani, he's co-founder of Infosys, and he was also India's digital ID architect. He ran the Aadhaar digital ID system. And then Karstens is the general manager of the Bank for International Settlements. So we've got these digital ID world and tech world. We got big banking colliding, coming together to try to rule over everything that's going on in the financial digital space. So one of the things they talk about is tokenization. And this is where on these unified ledgers where this programmability can come in. So there's a fellow by the name of George Gammon. He's done some nice presentations on tokenized deposits and what they are. So he knows a lot more about this than I would. But the basically, like, anything that's in the physical world, you can make dirt virtual and put it on a token. And then on this ledger, there's it's rules. There's a smart contract on how these transactions and interactions take place. Now, I love the example that Gammon gave about, say you have a car, you're leasing a car, and you put, and so that becomes tokenized, virtual. And then, so what you wanna do, the people who are loaning the money out, there's a data exchange. So they can see, like, well, where are you driving? How fast are you driving? Do we need to up your the price of this because of how you conduct yourself? So that's one way into this whole programmability on these unified ledgers. And to me, it seems like it leads to a social credit system.
Do you think that you're going to create a section on the website called, like, sociable engineering to cover things like this?
Probably. I mean, a lot of the sections I have kind of co-mingle into that sort of thing. So yeah, that's a pretty good idea.
Yeah. Well, you're such an amazing, I mean, I asked for a launch pad. You just went through the first couple of questions, like, concisely that I had. You, like, literally went, like, what is the Finternet, which is something that I'm not completely attuned with. And of course, Karstens and Nilekani and who these guys are. Is this why they've become so central to the implementation of this agenda? Is it simply they're the top of that hierarchy, or have they been doing other things behind the scenes to kind of promote globalist financial system?
Well, yeah, that's what the BIS is all about. But also in the case of Nandan Nilekani, he is the biggest proponent of digital public infrastructure out there. And he's been doing this for years. And even going back to the G20 last year was all about highlighting India and how they were so successful at their DPI rollouts. And then that's what the G20 said to all the countries: you need to define what digital public infrastructure is and then roll it out. We don't even know, so, like, they didn't even know how to define it yet, but then saying roll it out. And that the DPI, that consists of digital identity, fast payment systems, digital fast payment systems, and massive data sharing, which the Finternet combines all of those as well. So it's just, so you've got, yeah, the top of the top. Nilekani's been doing this for over a decade, even more so if you go back to Infosys. And then you got Karstens, who all the time, all he talks about is unified, programmable ledger, CBDC. And even, I think it was last year, he spoke at the same day that there was this big launch of a digital public infrastructure called 50 and 5, that was the UN and Bill Gates. The same day, separate event, Karstens was speaking at a BIS event, and he said that these digital monies, CBDC, will sit at the core of the future financial system. And back then, last year, didn't really define that. Now we have a definition or a word for it, and that's the finternet.
Yep. Well, listen, there's a couple of notes in the chat. I'm looking across at the chat and some people, Teresa Wild saying, bring back the Nokia 3210 and Snake, FCBDC and digital ID. I think there are lots of people agree with that sort of thing. And Alcid said, BIS, IMF need to launder $600 trillion in derivatives virtually. There is a question. I'm not sure if you'll understand it. Bitcoin halvening going on today. That's the question. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
you know.
I saw a couple of things on that on Twitter, and I'm not sure. You know, I don't have any cryptocurrencies. I don't know what's going on with Bitcoin or Ethereum. I've never even had a credit card, and I'm just turned 39. So yeah, I don't really know too much about that.
Yeah, I know. I had to try and like understand recently. So we're going to take a quick break for the news. You're listening to today's news talk on TNT.
Here's some more potentially bad news.
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. Israel conducted a retaliatory strike against Iran early Friday morning following explosions near the Isfahan airport. This was in response to an attack from Iran last Saturday involving over 300 drones and missiles aimed at Israel. Google has terminated 28 employees who were protesting the company's involvement with the Israeli government during the Gaza conflict, citing violations of workplace policies.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa. Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
I'm here with Tim Hinchliffe, and I'm interested to ask, will this new financial system be designed with a one-world government in mind, do you think? Or is it a multipolar? So will there be other areas of the world who design their own systems?
Multipolar is what I believe. Previously, Parsons of the BIS, he's been in all his reports and speeches, he always talked about A1 unified programmable ledger and public-private partnerships. But with this new report, they're saying plural unified ledgers. And then I also saw another, it was a fleeting thing I saw on Twitter, a post or something, where Carsons was saying this is not one ledger to rule them all. So it's going to be multiple. So then that gives the idea, well, okay, that's not one thing. It's multipolar. But it's still the same financial, it's still the same technological foundation. It's still, they're all connected. So it doesn't matter. Yeah, one way you can do one, it might be a little different with characteristics for this one area or different over there, but it's on the same basic technology and runs on the same thing. So yeah, whatever nation or whatever company or central bank wants to do whatever they want with it, they can do whatever they want with it. But it's the same infrastructure.
Did he really use Lord of the Rings terminology to describe it?
Yes. Yeah, that's what I saw. Yeah, passing through. This isn't one to rule them all. Yep.
That's amazing. That's amazing. These guys, honestly. How long do you think before they start introducing the first CBDC somewhere properly, you know, really, really in the bigger country, not the developing countries?
For that, I mean, even in the U.S., there's so much back and forth with even different states saying we're not going to let this happen. So, you know, if you look at developed countries, I don't know, maybe Australia, but as in locations. As far as a time frame goes, I'm not sure because I haven't seen most of the projects I've seen about CBDCs have always been rollouts and testing in places like Singapore. Yeah, that one. That's kind of a smaller one, but I just see them rolling out and testing things in all these smaller countries and underdeveloped countries first. So, you know, if I were to give it a time frame, I'd do what the whole globalist thing is, 2030. That's what they're pushing for.
I noticed down in the chat again, I'm just looking at what El Cid's saying. He's asking another question, saying the Western dollar is dead. Is Eastern Asian BRICS currency QFS ready to go?
That it seems even the financial system in general just seems to be washing up. And I've seen this, you know, division between they talk about the de-dollarization and what BRICS represents and how these two things will fight and which one will come out on top. But I think this is all what is leading to the digital, you know, the whole CBDC thing is because they've realized that all the debt and the finance and the trillions of dollars or pounds or whatever that are gone, no one can pay back. They want a financial reset. So I think that's what the digital thing is going to be all about.
So you've been sorting through like the nuts and bolts of these issues for years, and there's not many people who are in journalism who actually know more about these things. So do you think they're as powerful as we perceive them, these people, or is it only our lack of alternative vision which makes them powerful?
It's perception is reality. So they put themselves out there, these big banks, big business, government, to try to show their dominance and show that why we need them. But really, if we wanted to, if just wanted to unite and say no, we could, and they'd crap themselves, you know, if the people ever came together to rise up against them. So they talk a big game. They try to put themselves as being the experts, the most knowledgeable, and the only ones, you know, who know better than you. And central banks, I think they're scared. They're terrified of losing control, of not staying relevant. That's why they wanted to get on top of all this digital stuff first. I think that's why they want to get rid of crypto or regulate the hell out of it, is because they're not, no one needs them, but they want to remain relevant. And this is why they issued the wholesale CBDC, which they issue to the central, the commercial banks, so the commercial banks can program things the way they do. It's just the way, like, because if you just had the central banks without the commercial banks, and then the central banks started to do programmability, people wouldn't have trust in them. So that's what they want, to have like some illusion of trust that we're just going to issue digital money. It's not programmable, like Christine Lagarde says of the EU, European Central Bank, but then the intermediaries, the commercial banks will. So that's why the commercial banks will be relevant. They can do all this programmability stuff. And then the central banks just sit up there at the top saying, look at what we did. Isn't this great?
Yeah, all powerful, like they're on Mordor or something. So you also talk about in the article about how the Finternet fits into the globalist vision to roll out the digital public infrastructure, which you mentioned, or the DPI agenda. Can you explain to us a little bit more what DPI is? Because I it's something that these words and these... these yeah, go on.
Yeah, sure. DPI, digital, it's a civic technology stack of three components: digital identity, digital fast payment systems, and massive data sharing. So they even said in the report that the Finternet plays into DPI rollouts, because it does it. It has all those requirements. And then also what Nandan Nilekani said last year during the IMF spring meetings, which are going on right now for this year's, he said that, what are the tools of the new world order, or the, not the new world order, the new world. He said, everybody needs a digital ID. Everyone needs a bank account. Everyone needs a smartphone. And that's how you get DPI. DPI is going to go into Finternet. Finternet has programmable money, CBDC, digital ID, everything. They're all combined, all connected.
I know El Cid is enjoying this and enjoying listening to you speak in the chat. He's saying a lot. He says, ledger rules, no corruption allowed. And CB stands for central banksters, gangsters. That's probably about true. So how do DPI and Finternet differ, or are they basically stepping stones on the same pathway to total globalist financial control?
So I see Finternet going into DPI as part of that larger architecture and structure. So the DPI is what is going to rule like all over people, governments, citizens' lives. And this is one method of getting there. It's one of the components, but it's one of the components, which is the fast payment system, but it includes all three of them, which is the digital ID, fast payments, and data sharing, because that's all what's in the internet as well. And I think it's only a matter of time once the metaverse comes out and metaverses that we'll start thinking about finterverse, but I haven't really explored that idea yet.
Wow, I bet you they have. I bet you they have in detail, and they've decided whether they're going to allow it or not. The Finderverse. It sounds like we're entering from Lord of the Rings rhetoric into Star Wars and Emperor Palpatine rhetoric to me. What do you think the best alternatives are to this agenda? Are there any alternatives out there that you've seen apart from crypto, or is that basically what we're looking at?
That's what I mean. A lot of people see it as, I never put any trust in crypto. And then people say, well, why put any trust in fiat? So the whole financial system's a mess anyway. I personally just want to pay in cash everywhere I go. I don't want Big Brother looking in. And I also don't really believe too much in the politics of things in any political party. So, you know, people say you can maybe vote your way out. I don't know how you can do this, but, just whenever, like even right now, when stores, banks, or whatever, you know, stop accepting cash, or they don't want to distribute as much cash, then you just go to a different one, or you know, not shop there or something. That's a small way, but in the future, looking forward, yeah, I don't know. I live in a mountain up in Colombia that tried to get away from it all.
I think you probably got it about right. Tim Hinchliffe of sociable.co, thank you very much for coming on and enlightening us about some of this nefarious business. Really appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you, Johnny.
Anytime. Now, you're listening to today's news talk on TNT.
Here's a bushfire fact. Bushfires can occur without warning. So, if you're traveling during bushfire season, here are three simple steps to remember. 1. Check the fire danger rating before you go. The higher the fire danger rating, the more dangerous the conditions. It may be safer to replan your trip. 2. Think about the area you're going to and what you would do if a fire started. How would you escape the area if you needed to? And where would you go? Check if there's a neighbourhood safer place. 3. It's dangerous to drive through smoke or fire. If you can't find a way to avoid the fire, park in a cleared area, face the car towards the fire, and turn the engine off. Then lie on the floor and cover yourself to protect yourself from radiant heat. Live bushfire ready. For more helpful tips, visit myfireplan.com.au today.
We are for pets. We do anything for them because they do everything for us. We are for people, for those who love pets unconditionally. We are for good, from adoptions and veterinary care to disaster relief and fighting pet hunger. We stand together to create a better world for pets and families in need. We are PetSmart Charities. For pets, for people, for good.
This is Johnny Vedmore on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to the Johnny Vedmore Show on today's News Talk TNT. That was a brilliant conversation there with Tim Hinchliffe. We got an excellent conversation coming up in the second hour, which is going to be emotional too. Before we get there, I'm going to go to my old friend, Basil Valentine, and we're going to discuss some of the current affairs going on. Basil, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Johnny. Great to be with you, and hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world. Well, was it an attack or wasn't it an attack? There were some explosions this morning in the Isfahan area of Iran, but relatively minor, close to the Iranian nuclear installations, but not close enough to be obviously targeted at them, with only minuscule damage done, so much so that the one of the fascists in the Israeli cabinet, Itamar Ben-Gvir, tweeted out the single word feeble when describing what was the much anticipated Israeli retaliation for last weekend's retaliation by Iran for the destruction of its consulate in Damascus. Well, where does all this leave us? It leaves us with Netanyahu under pressure to strike Iran again, only harder, from within his own cabinet and wider Israeli society. It leaves the Palestinian people particularly vulnerable because a backroom deal was apparently done with the White House, whereby Netanyahu agreed not to hit Iran hard and instead hit the Palestinians hard. That was the trade-off. Basically, the White House was issued with an ultimatum. Do you want World War III or we destroy Rafah? Take your pick. And unsurprisingly, the White House chose the destruction of Rafah. So for the time being, at least sort of semi-officially, the word is that the direct hits between Iran and Israel may be off for the time being, unless Netanyahu feels he has to cave into internal pressure and hit Iran again.
I do think that there's going to be a possibility of that, because I'm not sure Iran's going to just, if you retaliate against a retaliation of a retaliation, we are going down a bit of a dodgy road, but I'm not sure if Iran will strike back straight away, because I think that they will try and pull the better man sort of card, you could say, and try and look like all the bigger man sort of card. Israel looks so petulant by this, and it was such a very small strike. You're right; it's just a little poke in the Iranian beast's belly. Israel wanted to attack Iran, that's going to be extremely hard, isn't it? Because they'd have to go through either over multiple hostile countries or countries that wouldn't like Israel going through or over them, or they'd have to go all the way around the mulberry bush, up a strait or two, find a way that way. I just can't see how a war would happen unless they're just going to attack Hezbollah and their neighbors. How have the neighboring states of Israel, have any of those reacted to this strike?
Not particularly. I mean, they're all regularly bombed. Let's not forget that Israel regularly bombs Syria and Lebanon, seemingly with impunity. I mean, at different times in the last few weeks, it's bombed three countries simultaneously, Palestine, Syria, and Lebanon, all at the same time, and all while claiming victimhood. Of course, last night we had the US veto the resolution in the Security Council to recognize a Palestinian state and admit it fully to the United Nations. Worth noting that the Security Council voted in favor of recognizing a Palestinian state, 12 in favor, 2 abstentions, the United Kingdom and Switzerland, and 1 against. And that 1, of course, wields a veto. Today, the G7 meeting in the beautiful Italian island of Capri. They always pick nice places for these foreign ministers' meetings, don't they? They never end up in Burnley or, I don't know if there's anything wrong with Burnley, but you get my drift. They're always in these exotic beauty spots. Anyway, the meeting has broken up with Antony Blinken declining to elaborate any further on the reported Israeli strike on Iran, except to say that the US had not been involved, and that while the G7 is committed to Israel security, we're also committed to de-escalating. They also seem to be committed to ramping up the sanctions on Iran, even though no one was killed in last weekend's attack, and we know 15,000 children and 50,000 civilians have been killed in Israel's assault on Gaza, but no word of sanctions on Israel. Well, not from the G7 anyway.
Yeah, I'm looking over in the chat. I'm seeing that Jason Brooks is saying these presenters don't have a clue what comes next, but I'm not sure I'm clairvoyant enough to know what's going to happen next. I can just report and comment on what's actually happening here and now, and it just seems to be slight tit for tat, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I like that comment. I'll tell you then straight out what's going to happen next. Nothing is going to happen next between Israel and Iran. It's all going to go quiet for the time being until somebody decides, you know, in a week, 2 weeks, month's time that they're going to attack either. Well, it'll be difficult to attack the sovereign country, so the soil, actually Iranian soil. Although the consulate is technically Iranian sovereign territory, it isn't in Iran. So, you know, this particular series of exchanges are supposed to have come to an end now. That's the sort of diplomatic noise coming out of the Middle East, Washington, and everywhere else, for that matter. What else is going to happen next, though, is that the Israelis are going to launch a full-scale ground invasion of Rafah, so-called the last refuge of the Palestinian people in Gaza. This was agreed by the White House in exchange for Israel not launching an all-out attack on Iran. Simple as that. Now, previously, the White House had been trying to get the Israelis to directly target Hamas, that instead of more indiscriminate bombing and mass murder of civilians, that the Israelis would employ commando-style tactics to, you know, root out only the terrorists. That was what the White House was pushing for. It seems now that the White House has caved in on that requirement and is going to allow Israel to destroy as much of Rafah as it wants and to continue to starve the people in the north. They don't really care about the consequences for the Palestinian people.
I think you've just proved Jason Brooks wrong, that these presenters do know what's coming next, because I agree with you as well. I think there's going to be a load of it. That's why it was just a little pinprick in the Iranian soil, because they don't want to, they have no ability to escalate. If the Americans and the British don't want to get on board because Israel have enacted the first strike, that narrative-wise isn't going to work for them getting involved. And to be perfectly honest, election year, the worst time for Israel to think that they can poke any of the Western nations like Britain and America into war, because of course they won't want anything to do with that. Now, there is another question, I think specifically directed at you in the chat here, is from Lorianne, saying, when are you opening a new X account?
Oh, well, I hope to get the old one reactivated at some point. Thank you for the comment. I was permanently banned as a result of something I said to the former Israeli spokesman Ilon Levy, which he didn't like and which he reported, but he's since been sacked because he's a liar, so, you know, perhaps I can get my account back. The EU has today apparently imposed sanctions on 4 individual Israeli settlers for serious human rights abuses against Palestinians. The individuals on the list are Neria Ben Pazi, Yinon Levy, age 32, Mayor Mordecai Ettinger, considered a leading figure of the Hilltop Youth, a radical youth group consisting of members known for violent acts against Palestinians and their villages in the West Bank, and also Elisha Yered, reported to have engaged in settler violence through so-called price tag attacks, including physical and psychosocial harassment, beatings, murder, and demolition of property against Palestinians of a systemic and systematic nature. Yet worth remembering, 300 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since October the 7th. But, you know, how come the EU are willing to sanction 4 individuals for murdering Palestinians in the West Bank, but refuse to countenance sanctioning the Israeli government for murdering 50,000 in Gaza? It makes no sense, Johnny.
Yeah, the amount of hypocrisy is out of control. One of the names you mentioned there was Ilon Levy. That's not Ilon Levy who was the spokesman for Israel who got fired. He didn't go straight out to the settlements and start causing trouble, did he?
No, sorry, that was somebody called Yinon Levy, Y-N-O-N Levy. It wouldn't surprise me, though. No, the Hylan was responsible for getting me kicked off Twitter. Let's pivot to a different part of the world now. And India, the world's biggest democracy, began voting this morning in a general election which has no fewer than 969 million registered voters, Johnny. 471 million of them women. They're expected to cast their ballots in seven phases of voting. They have to do it this way because the country is so populous and so vast. Seven phases of voting over 44 days, with the votes counted slowly and the results announced on June the 4th. It's widely expected that the Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi will win another majority. I can remember when the Congress Party, the one that unified Muslims and Hindus, was the natural party of government in India. But it seems the BJP, the Bhartiya Janata Party of Modi, is now the people's choice, including, ironically, many Muslims.
Indeed. Now, when Gloria Steinem was first recruited by the CIA via an Indian a trip to India in around 1956-57, she ended up suddenly hanging out with N.M. Roy and the widow of N.M. Roy and Indira Gandhi and others being there with revolutionary. I got a feeling that was because they were very communist leaning always in India. When did that change? When did communism just get knocked out of India then?
Well, that's a very good question. In the 1980s, arguably. I mean, in a country as vast as India, with such rapid growth both of population and its economy, it's fast becoming a technological powerhouse. Then competence in government and the ability to manage the basics on a day-to-day basis are considered of paramount importance. The crime rate in India is down. Roads have improved. Gas prices are down. So long as, you know, the leader is able to avoid catastrophe and establish peace and development, then you tend to get elected over and over again. But Modi's natural majority amongst Hindus means that many people feel that the country is heading towards an electoral autocracy. Now, we know, you know, the elected dictatorship, man. So we've heard that in the past, haven't we, Johnny? I think it applies as much to the likes of Britain and the United States as it does to India. Both parties in Britain are neoliberal Zionist warmongers. Both major parties in America are the same. So you have to go to countries where they have some degree of genuine proportional representation, which enables insurgent parties, whether of the left, like Podemos in Spain, or of the right, like Ms. Meloni's party in Italy, where, you know, the genuine voices of the people can be heard. Because certainly in the West here, we have a desperate and growing democratic deficit.
Yeah, it's hard to introduce any type of new voting system when the people in power benefit completely from the current system. And India is such a complicated place. I was watching a lot of the coverage during COVID of police beating people with long sticks. They tend to have these long sticks they like to beat people with in India to keep them under control. And I don't think we'd want to adopt any of that in our systems, but we're going that way anyway. Was it the AR system that Nick Clegg was trying to campaign to introduce here for proportional representation?
We had an absolutely feeble damp squib of a referendum during the so-called coalition. I mean, if it had been full PR, people might have gone for it, but it was a desperately watered down single transferable vote, I believe, which would have made virtually no difference at all and was comprehensively defeated. Somebody else who's going to be comprehensively defeated is Rishi Sunak. Record unpopularity for the British Prime Minister. He's completely underwater. The Tories polling only in the teens in the latest opinion polls. Just 19% of respondents said they would vote Conservative for the next general election. So we're in for a change in Britain, even if it's more of the same with Keir Starmer.
I say join the spoiler ballot party. Thank you, Basil Valentine, for all your hard work. Always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
Thank you, Johnny. Have a great weekend.
You too. Excellent. Well, in the next hour, I'm going to be speaking to an amazing couple with a devastating story to tell. To all of you wonderful folks who are watching and listening, don't go anywhere. All of you in the chat, keep speaking. You're listening to the Johnny Fedmore Show on today's News Talk, TNT.